Okay, Michael, we're live.
Okay, welcome to another episode of the 3-Minute Therapy podcast. I'm Dr. Michael Edelstein, clinical psychologist. I'm here with my partner, Dr. David Ramsey Steele, REBT expert. And today we have a special guest, Mike Kane, who is a drug counselor in LPCC. And Mike will tell us about his experience as a drug counselor and has some questions for us. So Mike?
Yeah, great. So like I was saying before the show, it took me a while to come to REBT. I first kind of practiced mostly as a Rogerian therapist and then went through into motivational interviewing and have really landed at REBT as the most effective psychology with my patients. I work with people that come in with a lot of shame from addiction and a lot of shame from mental illness. And I find that most of my time is best served by working on acceptance, because even motivation really has its roots in self-acceptance. Because we find a lot of people that want to get internally motivated, but they don't have that internal acceptance. And it causes some dissonance, I think, in making moves towards recovery.
Okay, very good. So I assume, Mike, you teach them some of the basic principles of REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, as
That's
a start.
Right.
Is that right?
So That's
one
right.
of the basic principles is our situations or our behaviors cannot create emotions, but rather it's always our thinking about our behaviors
That's
or
right.
about situations that create our emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So you said they have shame from addiction,
mm-hmm.
Indicating that the addiction causes their shame.
Yeah.
So it's good. I teach semantic accuracy, which means teaching therapists to be accurate in how they speak and accurately reflect reality that we're teaching. So that's just a side note.
Yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, that's totally correct. And I feel that, you know, addiction, when people are suffering from addiction, they do make choices that are against their values. And that often leads to self-downing, to shame. And so, yeah, I do absolutely teach that. So it's an acceptance of the disorder. But of course, that we're bigger than the disorder. We have a disorder. We aren't a disorder. You know, that's why I really encourage my patients, call them patients here, clients, to not say I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic, to feel that that's, inaccurate for one, but also can be destructive.
Yes. To get more of a context, Mike, what kind of drug problems do you normally work with?
Anything and everything. Methamphetamine is a big problem these days. Heroin, marijuana, alcohol, you name it, pretty much.
Yeah.
What about opioids?
Yeah. So heroin, fentanyl. And one of the problems we're seeing with heroin is it's being cut a lot with fentanyl, mm-hmm. or they're even making, opiate prescription medications that are cut with fentanyl. They look like Percocets, but they're actually fentanyl. So we're having a lot of overdoses with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So getting back to your main issue in terms of working with them,
yeah.
and that is their shame or lack of unconditional acceptance.
Yep.
What is their main objection to, if there is one, or what's some examples of some of their objections when you teach them unconditional self-acceptance, which means no matter how poorly they act, that doesn't turn them into bad people. It turns them into imperfect humans who act badly, like everyone else. And what kind of objections do you get to that?
Yeah, I get a lot of objections. I think that I think it's a radical idea for some people. It was for me when I discovered it, based on cultural influences and our own thinking and family's thinking. So I think at first people will say they understand it intellectually, but they don't feel it. And then what that tells me is that their belief that they're not worthwhile is stronger than the new information that I'm giving them. So we do a lot of repetition. Actually, the way I got heard about you, Dr. Edelstein, other than Deborah Jaffe Ellis, is your paper on the trouble with self-esteem. So we read that in group, and that's helped, very helpful. But it you know, we do a lot of ABCDE work on the board, talking about, you know, I have to be sober is one of the beliefs that we work on, and basically we're not our addiction, we're not what we've done.
Right. Very good. Yeah. And one of the things you just said that I really liked is you said you do a lot of repetition, mm-hmm. and that's really important. And you said they understand it intellectually, but they don't feel it. And the way I look at that is that there are two levels of understanding, level one and level two. Level one, as you said, sometimes is called understanding it intellectually, or having a superficial recognition that they're not bad people. But level two is being convinced, deeply feeling it, believing it, and acting on unconditional self-acceptance. So that takes repetition, practice, reinforcement, as you said.
Yeah.
Now, when someone says they understand the concept, a good approach, I think, is to say, okay, in your own words, what's your understanding of what I said? Mm-hmm. What's your perspective on it? And see if they actually at least understand it intellectually or superficially. Because if you explain something to someone, often they'll say, yes, I understand, but that doesn't tell you anything. You don't know if they do or not unless you ask them, give them a little quiz, a surprise quiz, and you ask them how do they interpret what you're saying. So that's something you could try.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Another aspect is, you know, I attempt to create a culture within the group with these concepts so that, you know, the clients catch each other and, you know, using absolutistic language and, you know, talking about their mistaken beliefs or irrational beliefs. And so I find it really helps when it's not just coming from me, but it's coming from the culture of the group as well.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. David, did you want to say something there?
I think there is a problem in getting people to understand the difference between self-acceptance and approval of everything you've done to date. they're not the same thing, of course. I think there are some kind of rhetorical tricks that can be employed to bring home the difference. And one thing I think of is you know, research has shown that 98% of the cells in the human body are completely replaced mm-hmm. every 7 to 10 years. So another way to look at that is we're built for renewal. And there's the spontaneous tendency for things to go away. And if anybody thinks back over their life, things they were terribly worried about 10 years ago, they're probably not thinking about at all now. They may even have forgotten that they were worried about it. So there is this kind of natural tendency in human beings to write a new slate from time to time.
Yeah.
And if people actively resist this with things they're telling themselves, you know, they've got this ideology. It's like an ideology, you know, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, which of course is being preached all the time by the media in response to Alcoholics Anonymous. well, you know, it just isn't true. You know, I was just thinking that exactly 60 years ago, for several months, I used to bite my nails. And it was a terrible problem. I was biting them right down and threatening to injure my fingers, you know. And then it suddenly went away for no particular reason. And then I remember, and it struck me sort of about a year later, hey, I used to bite my nails, but I don't anymore. So it seems to me there's a natural tendency in human beings to move on and change. But the ideology holds you back. You think, I am an alcoholic. I am a nail biter. You know, and I mean, another example would be having a tune on the brain, you know, having a melody like a jingle, and you can't get it out of your head. Well, you can imagine someone thinking, I'm going to be cursed with this for the rest of my life. But of course, we all know that a couple of weeks ahead, you're going to completely forgotten this. And it's, you know, so it doesn't frighten you in the same way that alcoholism or heroin addiction frightens you.
Yeah. Yes, that's an excellent point, David. Another way to put it is humans are a process. We're always changing. So to say, I am no good because I have an addiction, really puts that in stone. If you equal a no good Nick because you're acting in a no good way, then that's you, that defines you, just like I am an alcoholic. So that is against unconditional self-acceptance. Also, in terms of self-acceptance, not only are people always changing, but the evidence is, to support David's point, that people who have alcohol problems grow out of it, to use that term, after a certain number of years. And I imagine that's true with other addictions also. Yes. Because it loses its novelty, its curiosity, and it becomes monotonous and tedious, and people tend to shy away from that type of thing.
Yeah. I have a question. I think it's right along with this. I have found, you know, one of the things that clients will come back to me with is mistaking acceptance for resignation.
Right, okay? Right.
So,
right,
yeah, I accept that I'm a loser alcoholic. You know, and so it's this embracing of the irrational belief, and just kind of learned helplessness, maybe. I don't know, but being curious on your thoughts.
Yeah, so you could distinguish between accepting yourself and liking your behavior, as David said. So I think resignation means that you like your behavior, or there's nothing you can do about your behavior if you accept yourself. So it is important to distinguish between your evaluation of your total self and the evaluation of your behavior. And then you could go to the extreme, I am not my behavior, but that's not what we're saying. You are, the evaluation of you is not the evaluation of your behavior, but you do your behavior, so you don't want to rationalize and say it's not my fault or not my responsibility, it's your responsibility. But that's good news. If you are responsible, then you could do something about it. Another point you could make about unconditional self-acceptance is that if you don't accept yourself and you think of yourself as a bad person when you act poorly, when you act addictively, then that implies you're a good person when you act well.
Right.
But since humans have a tendency to focus on the negative, they'll just focus on their poor behavior and put themselves down if they're a self-rater and not counter the countervailing positive behaviors also.
Yes. And it puts a whole lot of pressure on being sober when you're thinking that way.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That's another thing that comes up, and that is sometimes people with REBT, we try to help people identify their absolutistic thinking, musts, shoulds, supposed tos, have tos. So sometimes people with addictions might do something about thinking, I must drink or I must satisfy my urge. But then when they're doing better, then they might tend to think, I must not drink. I must not satisfy my urge. And when you put that kind of pressure on yourself, then it tends to be more difficult to stay on the straight and narrow. So I try to show them that although it's false to say I must not drink, I must drink, it's also false to think I must not drink. It's still a choice. The bottom line is a choice. There's a book by Jeffrey Shaler called Addiction is a Choice. And when you recognize that, then you have more power.
It's an excellent book, by the way. Worth reading.
I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Addiction is a Choice, Jeffrey Shaler.
I found, too, that when we're thinking have to drink, have to not drink, we're not thinking of consequences. We're not emphasizing choice. It tends to get people feeling all sorts of emotions, extreme emotions, anger, fear, all sorts of things that are unhelpful. So yeah, we do a lot of work on that, emphasizing choice, really realizing that there's a lot of choices that lead up to that choice as well. So it's definitely back to what you were saying about people being a process.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. Now on the behavioral end of it, sometimes it helps to use some kind of competing behavior instead of the shooting up or the drinking, such as eating rather than drinking, eating something, or going for a walk, or going to bed, or texting a friend, or reading something, watching something. So it's good to have a list of competing behaviors for your clients that they
Absolutely.
Can do instead.
Yeah. And that includes, you know, for me, really advocating for changing the way we look at self-medicating, you know, because that's what I really think we're doing a lot of times. And to look at, you know, calling up my psychiatrist, calling up my psychologist, counselor, as another alternative behavior when I don't feel good. So it's, there's a lot of other options out there than using, that's for sure.
Right, right. Another choice in behaviorally in helping them get off their drug is tapering versus abstinence.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who have had a heavy drinking problem do better with abstinence. But another option is tapering. Now, so that might be something to present to them.
Definitely.
Also, go on.
I was just going to say, where I work here, we are an abstinence-based program.
Oh, yeah.
Although, we give a lot of flexibility within that. And I will present it sometimes like an experiment. I'll say, let's do an experiment for 4 or 5 months here and see what it's like to really make sobriety a priority. But, absolutely, you know, old school abstinence only programs are really tend to be shaming, in my opinion, a lot of times. So
shaming in what sense?
Shaming in that if I make a mistake or 10 mistakes in using within a program, I've failed, and then it so easily jumps to, you know, I'm a failure, like we're talking about. And so behaviorally, if we can, as providers, give them the landscape or the freedom to make some mistakes and to not feel bad about it, or feel maybe regretful about the use, but not you know, shaming, self-doubting, then I think we can help people a lot better that way. Yeah.
Anything else related to unconditional acceptance or objections that you've gotten from clients that we haven't covered?
I think we covered it pretty well. I think, you know, all three, cognitively, emotively, and behaviorally, you know, we really need to not pull any punches on the techniques and use all three as much as possible to really get change to happen. I give, you know, we do a lot of homework in the sessions, you know, the 5-hour sessions, because in individual therapy, I can get people to do homework a little easier. I found that it's hard to get people to, after 5 hours a group, to do homework. But so we do quite a bit of disputing type homework right in group.
Yeah. And you mentioned three approaches. You use cognitive, behavioral, and emotional. Now, what could you talk more about what you mean by emotional?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I would say, in the sense of identifying what emotions are coming up from the irrational beliefs that are being held. Like, we talk a lot about shame. And I'll put on the board, like, regret, guilt, and shame. And we'll look at each of those and really help teach the clients that they might not even think they're having a cognition or a belief with the feeling, but they are. And so we work to identify that. We do, I mean, do some coping skills too. Like, we meditate, bring in some mindfulness meditation every day for some emotional regulation. And, you know, when people are doing, we do some affirmations, and I'm clear that it's with them, that it's not positive psychology, but that it's a way to affirm what they're trying to replace their rational thinking, and having them do that emotively. So, you know, not just say I'm strong, but really, really belt it out in group would be one example of that.
Not I'm strong, I act strongly, or I'm capable of acting strongly.
Better even. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Another strategy, Mike, which you might be including under emotional, is imagery. And Albert Ellis called that rational emotive imagery. And in our book, David and I call it 3-minute imagery.
Okay.
And are you familiar with that?
I am. I'm familiar with the original. I can't remember who Albert Ellis said that he really kind of got the idea from, but the imagery where imagining an upsetting event and then rationally disputing using imagery and self-talk to bring it down to an appropriate emotion. Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah. The person you were thinking about was Maxie Maltsby,
right,
who originated it, but he had positive imagery where you picture yourself succeeding.
Okay.
But with rational emotive imagery, you picture the worst, which is you're having a very strong urge to drink, shoot up, indulge. And then you allow yourself, that's step one, where you picture the situation where you have the strong urge. Step two, where you let yourself get in touch with some compulsive behavior, such as drinking, and notice what you're telling yourself, such as, I must satisfy my urge. And then step three is the step you spend most time on, where you picture yourself saying, I don't have to satisfy my urge. I don't, I can stand feeling uncomfortable, etc. While picturing the same situation. So that would be rational emotive imagery.
Very good.
And it's another practice and repetition and reinforcement.
It's very good. And you bring up can't standarditis. And that is something that I do talk a lot about too, that, you know, the cravings will pass.
And you're saying I can't stand it. Well, obviously you're standing it. It hasn't killed you to have these unfulfilled urges.
Right.
Yeah. And another prong is awfulizing.
Yep.
That it's awful to have these urges, and it's awful to feel frustrated. Whereas the truth is, it's just very uncomfortable, or very, very, very uncomfortable if you're giving up heroin and crawling the walls. But you have a better chance of surviving by putting up with that discomfort than you do by not and continuing with the drug.
Absolutely. And I think it leads right back to the self-acceptance too. You know, I shouldn't be having these cravings. What does that say about me? Maybe I don't want it badly enough, or it could lead to a whole stream of, I think, irrational cognitions like that.
Right, right, right. Okay, anything else that you wanted to mention, Mike, or David, you wanted to mention?
No, I think we've covered quite a bit.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Well, I just want to thank you guys for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mike, for coming on. Mike Kane, a drug counselor. Where are you, a drug counselor?
Yeah, I'm in St. Paul, Midway St. Paul, Minnesota. Uh-huh. And, I'm here full time, and I live out in the burbs a little bit.
Right. And if someone lives in your area and would like to get into your program, how would they do that?
Yeah, they could go to www.nb, as new beginnings, nbminnesota, all spelled out, .com. And then you could also, if people wanted to email me, you could email me at michael.kane@nbminnesota.com.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, Mike, for coming on. And if you're viewing and you'd like to come on with David and I, Mike survived. He looks no worse to wear.
It was great.
You probably survive. If you're a therapist and you like suggestions, or if you're a non-therapist but have some problems you'd like to discuss, please let us know. We'll be happy to speak with you. And David has written a number of very interesting, notable books. David, do you want to mention the name of some of your favorites?
Oh, I wrote a book about George Orwell. It's a study of his thinking, what he believed. My most recent book is a collection of my previously published articles. It's called, what's it called? The Mystery of Fascism, David Ramsey Steele's Greatest Hits.
Right. Very good. That's David Ramsey Steele. And I'm Dr. Michael Edelstein. I'm a clinical psychologist with 40 years experience doing rational emotive behavior therapy. And there's a website you could check called 3minutetherapy.com, 3 spelled out. Get our book, 3-Minute Therapy. It's a great book. If you don't believe me, ask David. And tune in for our next episode next Tuesday. And our episodes are streaming. So if you'd like to participate, ask questions, you're free to do that. So it's Tuesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you have any questions about anything in the book or objections to anything in the book, let us know, or even come on and we can discuss that. If you're a psychoanalyst, we'd be happy to entertain your ideas. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you next Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time.